Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Jason Coleman, and you are listening to Things That Make You Go, Book Review Podcast. And welcome back to another episode. It's so nice to have you guys back for another one of my book reviews. Although calling what I do a book review, I think is not exactly accurate. What I do, I think, is much more along the lines of a book discussion, where I read a book and then I filter how the book flows through my own psyche, some of the own connections and ideas that I've made after reading the book, how I think it's going to apply to my life, how it may be applicable to someone else's life, and that's what I talk about. So let's go ahead and get to it. Today I'm going to be reviewing the book The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable by Nassim Taleb. So I'll have to be honest with you guys. I was a little, I had a little bit of difficulty getting through this book. It reads very much like a textbook in a lot of parts. I know that Nassim Taleb is very high, he's a scholar. He, you know, works at a lot of different universities. He does a lot of lecturing and stuff. And I think he mostly worked his career on Wall Street as, kind of not necessarily a hedge fund manager, but as a hedge fund advisor, I think. And what his basic job was to advise people or companies on risk management, like how to know if something they're getting into is too risky, what kind of things to avoid, and so on and so forth. And so he said he's pretty much spent his entire life around stock market investors. And that prompted him to want to write this book, because what he was saying is that what he finds, especially in the financial markets, are a lot of people who claim to be able to forecast the future. So I think originally his book was going to be just about why you should be very skeptical of people who claim to know about what's going to be happening in the future. But I think what it evolved into is just a book about how knowing the future in general is very difficult, if not downright impossible. And that doesn't necessarily sound like something that is some revolutionary idea. And I agree. I mean, you've probably heard people say all throughout your life, you know, you can't predict the future. You never know what's going to happen. Other sort of platitudes. And I think on one level, people sort of believe that, but I think on a much deeper level, we really don't. We either believe that it's possible to know the future if you know the right people or you study the right things, or through a series of, I don't know, you know, hidden information accessed by the right people, information about the future can be had. Or, you know, there certainly has been a number of people who've been able to make a lot of money by at least giving the impression that they can predict the future, with your time and with your money. Now, personally, I think that a lot of this is very highly dubious myself. I've always kind of wondered about it. I kind of find the same thing when I hear people talking about the importance of organic food and, why some food is much healthier than other food. And I know there's kind of an extreme. I know eating high amounts of cholesterol on a daily basis over long periods of time is probably bad for your heart. But I don't know. When it gets into kind of the minutiae why, canned beans are less healthy than fresh beans, I mean, what exactly are people saying? I mean, what's going to be happening to you over the course of your lifetime if you eat canned beans instead of fresh beans? Like, we don't really know. Nobody knows. You know, the human body is, it's kind of strange like that. But it doesn't stop people from wanting to be able to gain some kind of control. I think about that sometimes when I go to the doctor. Like, they'll measure my blood pressure and they'll say, oh, your blood pressure is a little high, or the protein in your kidney output is slightly above normal, or you know, your resting heart rate is a little on the high side kind of thing. And I don't really think, I mean, everybody's body is a little bit different. It's kind of like the body mass index. I mean, I think it's maybe a good general marker, but you, when you try to apply things from the general to the specific, it's not always going to work out for you. I mean, one of the things I know for sure is that cholesterol medication is prescribed pretty often. I mean, my dad's on cholesterol medication. I have a number of friends who have taken cholesterol medication. And I guess the theory is that if your cholesterol is high, then you take cholesterol medication, making your cholesterol lower, and that will that'll stop heart disease, I think. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, being married to a physician, I've had conversations about this. And from at least the available research that I've been able to find, I haven't seen anything to suggest that if you have high cholesterol, but you don't have any other health risks or you don't have any other risk factors, the researchers aren't even sure if that even poses a risk towards heart disease. It's just it's all probabilities. You don't know. It's hard to say. So anyway, I definitely agree with the author in that respect, that we certainly are surrounded by people who claim to know or at least help us see the future. And he says it's all bogus. You just don't know. And what makes it even harder than that, to just accept that, is our brains might even be hardwired to believe that we can predict the future. Now, he talks about three things three reasons why our brain is susceptible to believing that we can know the future. He calls it the illusion of understanding, where because we study something and because we hear experts talk about it, then we believe that we now have a full grasp of information and control over the subject. And I think now is probably a good idea. Now it's probably a good time to talk about where the author came up with the title for Black Swan. What he was saying was that ornithologists never believed that a black swan could exist. They'd never seen any black swans. And so in their minds, the whole concept of a black swan existing was just impossible. Well, it never occurred to them that maybe the reason a black swan doesn't exist is just because maybe they do exist, but you haven't seen one yet. And that's what wound up happening when an ornithologist finally found a black swan. They had to completely recreate and redesign their own understanding of bird anatomy, or, you know, bird speciesization, or whatever the case is. So this is what our illusion of understanding is we believe we have full control and knowledge over certain topics until something happens and it flies in the face of what we thought we knew, and then we have to redesign what we thought we knew. And then it kind of begs the question, well, did we really know what we thought we knew? And I thought that was really interesting. The next thing he says is that we have retrospective distortion, meaning that we can only make sense of things after they happened. I think another way of, I've heard other people talk about this, and they call it backwards narration, where after a series of things have happened to you that seem like they were unpredictable, when you start to reflect back on all the steps that happened, all of a sudden it makes perfect sense. But unfortunately, what it does is it kind of gives you the illusion that everything that happened to you was actually controllable if you had just been looking for a few steps along the way. And it reminds me of the quote by the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard, who said that life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards. Forgive me if I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but meaning that, yeah, of course you're going to, I mean, or I think probably an even better one would be hindsight is 2020 kind of thing. So no, we feel like just because we understood all the steps that happened that led up to an event, that therefore all of those steps were both predictable and rational, and probably neither of that situation was true. I think about court cases sometimes, how in court cases, that's exactly kind of what the prosecution tries to do. They try to create a backward, at least in, you know, criminal prosecution cases, I should say. The prosecutors try to create a backwards narrative of all of the steps, like a recreation model of everything that happened that led up to the criminal committing the crime. Okay, and what they want to try to do is they want to try to make it seem so obvious and so clear for the juror that there is no fuzzy steps along the way that might cloud their thinking. But in reality, life is just a series of cloudy steps. You never know exactly how things are going to turn out, but for some reason, we seem to think that we could have had control if we were just a little bit more careful. And I think in that sense, we may be being a little bit too hard on ourselves. And the third one, main point he was making, which I think kind of goes along with the first point also, is the overvaluation of factual information. He calls it platonify, meaning that once we have facts, then we can then use the facts in order to, guide us into correct decision making. And even that is, I don't know, I think that's really highly dubious. I mean, I'll just speak to what I have the most experience with, and that's working in education. And so what we do in education is we'll find one school that is doing a few different things, and they've been able to achieve, you know, very high academic results with their students. And so the theory goes is that, well, with those facts, if you just recreate that model, then you'll, in theory, achieve the same results. But we've seen, well, at least I've seen, schools I've worked at over the years try to recreate models that were working in other schools and not have nearly the amount of success. I mean, really, if it were as simple as that, then you would think that, you know, anybody who imitates anything, whether it be in the sciences, whether it be in the arts, entertainment, whatever the case, you'd have the same amount of success. But again, just because you have a fact doesn't necessarily mean that all the nuance in all of the, I guess, all of the unspeakable factors, or maybe that we don't necessarily understand everything that went into the fact, that is also present in the situation. But of course, once we understand that, then our brains begin to backwards narrate, and then we criticize ourselves for not understanding what we didn't understand in the first place. So it kind of becomes a bit of a vicious cycle, I guess you could say. Another way I think about it is, the author talks a little bit about this, is the butterfly effect, where very small instances, things that can happen in our life, can have profound changes in the long run. And what he was saying is that we might be able to think that our life is a predictable series of steps, of things that happen. Kind of like, I saw a meme on Facebook, on someone's Facebook wall, I thought was kind of interesting. It's how we envision our life transpiring. And it showed an X and Y coordinate graph with a line that was maybe about on a 35 degree slope that was gradually moving upwards in a straight line, almost a straight line. And they said, and then they juxtaposed that with what actually happens in life. And then the line was going squiggly back and forth, up and down, taking dips, going left, going right, okay, before finally moving in an upwards direction. And I think that's probably a lot closer to how it works out. And I think when students, when they pick majors in college, or they plan out like what they want to do with their careers, I think it gives them this kind of illusion that they can create some sort of a pathway of safety and security for their life. When in reality, what the author talks about is just a few events which are probably really unpredictable, that you didn't know they were going to happen, could very well and probably will determine the course of your life. I think now would probably be a good time to give an anecdote and how this applies to my own life. I can remember when, right after I graduated from high school, I was all set to go take this entrance exam for this college that I was going to go to. And what happened was, I kid you not, this is a true story. right before I was about to leave, I was carpooling with a friend of mine who was also going to go to that college. That's why I wanted to go to the college. My friend was going there. We were going to be roommates. We're going to have this great time. So right before he was waiting outside, maybe it was about an hour before he came to pick me up, I think, now that I think about it. I get this phone call from some family members back east, and they had just informed me that my grandmother had died that morning. She had been sick. She had had respiratory problems, complications from emphysema, but I knew she wasn't well, but she was young. She was in her mid-60s, so I didn't think that death was like on the horizon for her. But lo and behold, she did die, and she was kind of like a motherly figure to me in a lot of ways. And I was so distraught, I was so crushed that I could not even think straight. So I, of course, did not go take my placement test that morning. And because I didn't take the placement test, I was not given admissions to the school. I had to go onto the waiting list, so I went to a different college instead. That's where I met my wife. We traveled, we relocated across to the East Coast. I had a hard time finding a job, so I began working as a substitute teacher. That eventually led to me finding a full-time teaching position, even though I wasn't intending on getting into teaching. We eventually moved back here to California, where I'm currently living. And I am working as a full-time public school teacher now. And I just think to myself, how different would my life have been if my grandmother would have died one day earlier or one day later? It's quite the question. I mean, I know counterfactuals are always tricky, and you know, it's very easy to retcon your history sort of thing, but I'm fully convinced that just a couple of those events are what set the trajectory of my life. And I would say that the author would probably argue that you should understand that things like that are going to happen to you in your life, and don't necessarily try to predict them, but just be aware that these things could happen. Never become too comfortable that you fully have control over your future. I think sometimes about praying. I confess, I never understood exactly what the concept behind praying is. And whenever I ask my religious friends about praying, at least my Judeo-Christian friends, I get answers that are a bit tricky to comprehend, at least as far as I'm concerned. For example, I've always believed that if God already knows your entire situation, what you're thinking, what you're desiring, what you need, what you don't need, then he doesn't really need you to tell him these things, okay? He already knows what it is that, you know, you're going to need for survival or what's best for your life, and he'll provide you the things that he feels that you're going to need. So it just seems to me that asking for something that the person already knows that you need is redundant. It's unnecessary. So I think then what praying does is it gives us an opportunity to grasp control over things that we can't really control. And instead of being okay with the fact that it's going to be unpredictable, we just don't know, we prefer to have the illusion of security by saying, oh, well, perhaps if I ask for this, or perhaps if I let it be known with other people, you know, working in conjunction, then our combined psychic force will give us some sort of advantage in what's going to happen in the future. In some ways, I think it's a bit unfortunate that we think that way, because by doing that, we're distracting ourselves from probably what the real solution is, and that's just the acceptance of the unknown. We just don't know, okay? And the author isn't saying that because you don't know how the future is going to take place, then you should avoid taking risks. I remember this quite clearly from the book. What he was saying is that you should take risks, and in some situations, you should actually be very risky. I mean, my wife and I, with our investment, I personally think we're a little too aggressive with our portfolio, and we have actually lost a lot of money in these last couple of years. But the author would argue that it's not necessarily that taking risks is bad. Taking risks is completely essential for life. Where the problem comes in is how we feel is when you start to think that you can somehow grasp or see or have a field of vision all the potential risks that could happen to you when you can't. I mean, in reality, let's think about this for a second. Everything you do is technically a risk. If you get in your car and you drive to work, you've taken a huge risk, okay? There's a, one of the most common ways that people die, especially people under, 60 years old, is through car accidents, okay? So you are taking a risk, but the risk does not outweigh the potential reward in having a normal everyday life, that the risk is too small. But every day you are weighing risks versus rewards. Like, for example, when I eat unhealthy food, which I do a little bit more than I'd like to, I feel like I'm taking a small risk by eating, putting food that might be somewhat toxic into my body. But I don't think anything is going to happen to me right at that moment. So I'm taking a small risk in order to have the reward, which is the joy of a very, very good tasting food for me. So that's how the author is just saying you should go through life, is to not necessarily try to get control of the situation, but just understand that certain factors can't be predicted and they are out there. One of the gem tidbits, I don't know how related this was to his thesis, is he talks, but I remember this, is he talks about scalable versus non-scalable income. And it's kind of something I was thinking about either. And he was saying that when he was in business school, his colleagues and professors were telling him to try to find a job where the money he would make would be non-scalable. So, for example, let's say that you write a book and you make it an ebook and you publish it on Amazon. And that would be an example of non-scalable income, meaning that you don't have to write more books in order to sell more units, okay? So the amount of money you make is not dependent upon giving additional labor. Like, contrast this with, say, a massage therapist, okay? The only way that they make money is by giving massages, okay? So if they want to make more money, they have to give more massages, okay? Or same thing with a security guard, okay? If he wants to make more money, he has to guard for an area for more hours. That's just, how it goes. I mean, myself, I'm a teacher. In order to make more money, I have to teach more hours. Whereas, say, if I was a music star, okay, I'm not necessarily going to make more money by having more songs, okay? Because once I create a song, the amount of people who buy it doesn't affect the amount of labor that I'm putting into that song directly. So I think that works a lot in the financial markets, where what you try to do is you try to have what's called passive income, where the amount of money you have invested is bringing in money for you, so you don't have to create additional labor in order to make additional money. Okay. So what the author then said is that, unfortunately, the people who are, it's kind of a bit of a pyramid scheme, because when it comes to non-scalable income, there's only a very small percentage of people who control just about all of the amount of wealth that's purchased from these things. Okay. Like, for example, that's why we have like the greatest wealth disparity between CEOs and workforces, is because, so much money of non-scalable income is flowing into so few of people. So what the author was saying is that, like a pyramid scheme, yeah, if you can get to the top, having a non-scalable income job is great. But for everybody else, you might want to go with the scalable income, because at least you are being directly compensated for everything that you're doing. So that was just a tidbit of the book. And he has lots of them that stick with you. So I think in the end, I just want to say, like, if if how this book applies to me is I'm just going to be a little skeptical when I'm around people who claim to have certainty over the future, and just be aware that everything you do in life is going to have risks. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do them. You should just be aware of what the risks could potentially be when weighing your decisions. Okay. All right. Well, that is, I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up now. This actually ran a little bit longer than I was expecting, but I will be back in about 2 weeks with another book review. So thanks for listening. Please, if you can, if you have a little extra time, go on iTunes and leave a review, and or go on Stitcher and you know, or just tell your friends, and you know, just to help me grow the audience, because it's very validating for me to know when people are listening to my episode and they could take the time to enjoy what I enjoy so much, and that's, you know, discussing really great nonfiction books. Okay, that's all for now. Take care, and I'll see you guys in a couple weeks. Happy reading.